just a sign.
Go fade them. Play as time goes by.
Oh, I can't remember it myself. I'm a little rust down.
I'll hum it for you. Da-dai, da-dai, da-da.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman need man, and man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome as time goes by. And hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time.
Feedback.
So that'll take some editing.
Yeah.
We're doing it again.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. This is Nature Boy broadcasting live from K-Chung Radio in Chinatown, LA on 1630 AM or live on kchungradio.org. I am Michael and I'm joined here by John and Marshall.
Hey.
Hello.
Happy 5th of July.
Happy 5th of July. Yeah, Nature Boy does not pledge allegiance to any particular country, but rather to the Earth. So, they're not hungover. We didn't party.
No one. No. My voice always sounds like this.
I've been gone for a while. I've been gone for the last two shows.
Yeah.
And you guys have continued.
Yeah. I mean, I might even dare say that they were...
Better?
Oh my god.
I've heard good things. Somebody mentioned, somebody thought that the analogy of the little band inside the car.
Yeah,
that was a good one.
Was a really good analogy. I think that they were using it, like they had like little sound clips or something that they were submitting for some type of grant application or something, was my understanding. And that was like on the table as one of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hey, that's wonderful.
Just to show like the diversity of shows within K-Chung.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Oh, I'm really glad that somebody actually enjoyed it. I listened back to that episode and I was incredibly proud of it, actually.
Right?
Yeah, so you guys did the scientific method and alien life.
Right.
And we're going to kind of continue, I think, the theme of the last show. And so the theme of the show is astrophysics or just kind of like general things in space, I think, the universe. But so I've been gone for 2 months. I was away at a workshop, so I thought we can kind of just go around and do like a little update of what we've been up to. So
sure.
I went in a workshop for global food security at Purdue University, and I thought that it was really kind of eye-opening for me, because it was a lot about like sort of the policy that needs to happen behind science in order to actually enact it. So, you know, I think as scientists, we're very sort of limited in our scope, and we think that, you know, what we're doing is going to have, has potential impact on people's daily lives, but it's a really far way away from doing that without, collaboration with right people.
It's abstract and really far, really far out. And actually I'm reading right now this book called A Critique for Ecology. And that's one of the greatest weaknesses of contemporary ecology. And I know that right now my stepfather, who was schooled in environmental science, so basically an ecologist, is probably listening, but this is not meant as an indictment, but just a slight criticism, is that we all, in a lot of the fields of science, we imagine that our work will fit into this larger model that's maybe not specified or accurate even. Like, if the model that you're trying to fit your work into can't even make predictions and solve problems, then there's no point. You're building like a non-working machine, and you're just working on one
part. That's also how we're trained as scientists. We have to be able to, I mean, in order to get like funding and writing things up, it has to fit into a larger context, I think.
Yeah.
It can't just be like, you know, this isolated discovery that doesn't mean anything to anyone.
Broader impacts, right?
Yeah. Broader impacts, huge. So I went to that workshop and I thought it was really good. It was like really eye-opening for me to just see how focused science is, and then without, you know, looking at the bigger picture. So it was good for that. And then my research, so I don't know, I don't really have much update with my research, but I just to remind everybody, I do plant research, and my research focuses on how legumes can add nitrogen to the soil to reduce fertilizer inputs. So I'm working on that. I'll probably do some like chemistry this summer. Yeah.
Nice.
It's exciting times.
So we're doing recaps. My research is also with plants. I do turf grass research. So my projects are continually changing, but currently I'm working on using biochar as a soil additive. And
me too.
Yeah. We both actually do a collaboratory project between Michael and my labs. It's quote-unquote collaboratory, because your professor provides a lot of support and resources. And let's
leave
it at that.
Is collaboratory a word?
I just made it. That's where I work. I work in a collaboratory. Where do you work, bro?
I have collaborative relationships with my
It was
my
a brain thought that he had.
Yeah, that was a classic brain thought.
Classic brain thought.
And we should make shirts. So turfgrass research. My research right now is going splendidly. I've got a great greenhouse study, and I hope to have my first publication by the end of this summer.
Cool. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
He's moving fast.
Yeah.
What have you been doing in your time, Michael?
Not that.
Going to workshops, changing the world.
Just learning how little I change the world.
Thinking about it. So just to remind the listeners, my research...
Oh, no, that's okay, Marshall. We're fine. I love you.
Gosh. Just because I made fun of you a little earlier, you don't have to get back at me. Anyway, my research is more... it's also in plants, but it's more molecular-based. So my lab looks at... RNA interference and post-transcriptional gene silencing. And so lately I've been having lots of fun with a confocal microscope. I don't know exactly how to explain the technical.
Confocal. Yeah. So what does that mean? What is con?
That's when you have the two beams of light, right, that intersect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you have very specific, very, very narrow, field of vision, right? That helps so you avoid all the issues with
boom
resolution.
You did it. And so
I'm a big smarty pants.
You are. So I've been using the confocal microscope to look at where a couple of proteins are localizing inside of the cells. So it's lots of fun. I've been a little obsessed with it the last few days. So
Yeah. I'm hoping to do HPLC, which is high-performance liquid chromatography, like to detect chemicals. But I need to learn how to do that first, so that's what I'm going to be doing this summer.
I'm learning to do that right now, actually. Oh. Maybe we could have a little collaboratory effort. I can get you some access to our machine. Yeah. This is not a discussion to be having on the air, I'm sorry.
So I just wanted to remind everybody about what we do. So this is Nature Boy on K-Chung Radio, and we also are a podcast, so we're available on iTunes. The iTunes store under Nature Boy, the podcast.
Or
if you search for K-Chung, it's like one of the first
It will
results.
Show up pretty quickly under K-Chung. We also, I just got us on Stitcher, which is an app that you can download for non-Apple users.
Right.
And we actually get, if we get more than a certain number of listeners per month, we get a little kickback.
Oh, that's nice. So go use Stitcher.
So use Stitcher, please. Do that. And you can also go to natureboy.libsyn, which is libsyn.com, and that's the nicest just layout of all the episodes to listen to.
Do we have do we have a link on our website to Nature Boy?
I'm not sure we do.
Oh, we need to fix that.
SixSiblingsEgg.org.
Yes.
So there we are.
Okay, and then so some science news updates. So there was recently this big, very controversial law that passed in California. Governor Jerry Brown signed it, and it was a vaccination law. So
thank goodness.
It's one of the strictest in the nation, actually, and we're only, I think we're one of three states that now, so California joins Mississippi and West Virginia, which
are they banning vaccines? That's what that sounds like.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Have you not heard about this?
No. I've heard of this. I'm just making a joke because the
other states that are a part of this
the team
movement?
That we're joining. Yeah, yeah. Seems a little.
Yeah,
how
no,
dare
seem...
you guys? How dare you guys be so subjective?
Just
regarding
go to
these
any list
states.
Of like most obese, most high, like lowest number of high school educated people, and Mississippi is going to be number freaking one. So,
oh, so goodness. Well, we're joining them. They're progressive in this, I don't know, arena.
It's good.
Vaccination. So
yeah, it's exciting.
It's one of the nation's strictest laws. So now, starting in this 2016 school year, any child that attends a public, a private, or a daycare institution has to have their, like, several vaccines, and they list them here. I'm not sure. They're, like, you know, the general ones, like measles and all those other ones.
Any parent out there who, you know, wants to get around this law is going to have to start homeschooling.
Yeah, so you either have to homeschool your kid, or your kid has to have, like, a documented allergen or allergic reaction to some of the compounds in these vaccines. So then, obviously, there's... I think that this is a great new law, but there's been with a lot of protests, obviously.
Yeah. I think it is also a very good law. Who was talking about it just recently? It might have been on Freakonomics, where they were talking about how people like to think that they're altruistic and that they do altruistic activities, but not getting immunized is being extremely selfish, because you're not protecting the people around you who don't have the opportunity to get immunized.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's not just about, like, you know, you refusing the vaccine. It's like you're putting other people at risk as well.
Exactly.
So, obviously, a lot of celebrities and stuff live in California, so there's been... They've been... the ones that are against this sort of law have been very vocal, so...
Jim Carrey?
Yeah, Jim Carrey went on, like, a tweet kind of...
against...
He was like, stop corporate fascist California.
Oh, wow. Goodness gracious me.
Imposing these vaccines and...
it's just a character he's doing.
Yeah, probably.
I'm wacky anti-vaccine guy.
His opposition is to the levels of, like, mercury and aluminum that can be found in vaccines.
The Illuminati?
The Illuminati.
Oh, wow.
So there's this compound called I should have had this prepared. It's a mercury-containing compound that the name escapes me right now. And so it's added into vaccines as a preservative, so it's actually not an issue.
Is it a thermometer? Is that what you were thinking of?
Almost.
Oh, okay.
On the same track.
Wow, you are on a roll this morning.
Oh, I'm unstoppable. That's okay.
I'm just gonna.
Yeah, someone can look it up. They got the internet.
So it's added as a preservative agent to a lot of vaccines, and it's not actually really not for it's actually not a concern for us because you know the distribution here, like their vaccines are not likely to go bad before the time that they're used. Mm. But it's actually more for like developing countries, third world countries that. Yeah. These vaccines could have a much longer shelf life and be more stable and stuff. Mm-hmm. But because of the opposition to these ingredients from
the
anti-vaxxers, these have sort of been slowly removed out of vaccines over time. And so now, you know, like the potential benefits of these preservatives are being lost because people are scared of it. And so even... I read like some calculation that somebody did on this, and so even if that compound was added, it was like pure mercury, which is not. It just contains mercury in it. But the amount that each vaccine has, it would take about 150 shots at the same time to start approaching lethal levels of mercury. So it's like in such small amounts that there's really no. Ill effects, and I think that people don't realize that we like produce sort of like toxins all the time, and there's like small amounts of cyanide and stuff in a lot of the foods that we eat, and it doesn't really have any negative effects on us because, you know, a toxin is basically defined by the amount at which starts to have toxic effects. So mercury is not toxic inherently, it's just like at a certain level it starts to become toxic. So, I think that this is a good law for California.
I think so, too.
Yeah, and that's some science news.
Science news. Beep, 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 beep.
Okay, so moving on to the topic, I guess, for this month, we're talking about astrophysics and the universe. So, to define the universe, it's all of time and space and its contents. It includes planets, stars, galaxies, the contents of intergalactic space, the smallest subatomic particles, all matter and all energy. So it's basically everything. And actually, the majority of matter in the universe is dark matter and dark energy. So I had a little bit of a pie chart here, which is horrible generally in science. This was helpful. Let me see here. Okay, so the total mass energy of the known universe contains only about 4.9% ordinary matter, and that's like basically what we are, what we can see, what we can measure, and things like that. So that's 4.9% of all of the mass energy of the universe. The rest of it is dark matter and dark energy. So it's estimated that the universe has about 26.8% dark matter and 68.3% dark energy. So this is like the invisible sort of stuff that the universe is made out of.
And are we still incapable of detecting dark matter and dark energy, or have they found some way to indirectly?
We can't test or observe it directly. So the way that they do observe dark matter or dark energy is basically by proxy, like levels of radiation or things like that. They influence things like radiation levels, and that's how we observe them, but we can't really detect the dark matter, dark energy itself. Yeah. What else was I going to say?
Something incredibly
scientific.
Intellectual and scientific, yes. Mm-hmm. Edifying, mm-hmm. Illuminating.
Yes.
Anytime, waiting on you, Michael. Wow.
No, I think we should keep listing synonyms.
No, I was going to go on to about the size and age of the universe. So it's about it's estimated to be about 13.8 billion years old. And they use it with a model, some model that's has scientific credibility based on observations. They just look
it's
at
the light,
age
right?
of... Yeah, it's basically like the age of light or radio waves. Mm-hmm. And the size of it is obviously extremely large.
And the hue. Isn't there, like, the hue of the color of the light, right?
The so, phase, like, blue
versus right, blue versus red, right?
I think that helps. That helps
whether
measure,
it's coming towards you,
yeah,
or going
the rate
away
of expansion, right, yeah. Right.
Which is kind of fun and cool to think about.
It is kind of cool. Yeah. It's also cool to think about, like, don't we? Isn't it that all points are moving further apart because
exactly,
as we expand, right, outward? It is pretty interesting.
Isn't it weird? Yeah.
Yeah. How could we all be moving
away
from everything else?
Yeah.
And then everything else is moving away from everything else. Eventually, something has to be moving towards something else. But no.
So yeah, like the Earth, between the Earth and the edge of the universe, the edge of the observable universe, that's estimated to be a distance of about 46 billion light years away. And the entire universe altogether is estimated to be the length of about 91 billion light years. To put that in perspective, our Milky Way galaxy is about 100,000 light years, and the whole universe is 91 billion light years, which is actually kind of smaller than I thought it was.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. But also, this is still something like an unfathomable distance.
Right.
Right?
But it's also like the sort of the observable universe. So
okay,
I guess that's like where stuff stops, and you know it's continuing to expand outwards from that. So it's constantly growing, actually.
Well, or it's where we can see. So if we were at a different point in the universe, maybe we would see that it goes on more, right?
Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right.
Wait, what did you say?
I'm glad that you just agree with me.
I was grabbing a coffee. I have an excuse.
I thought I did, but then I was like, wait, what?
So the universe is 91 billion light years across, right?
Yeah.
From our specific point of view in the universe.
Right.
So if we were dropped, like, when you look on, like, Google Maps and put a pin in it, if we were dropped, put a pin in us kind of near the edge of our observable universe, then would we see that there's actually more universe from that vantage point?
Oh yeah. Another interesting thing that I found out about this was that, so right now the age of the universe and its expansion, even if, like, we emitted light waves right now, which is how we detect, you
mm-hmm.
know, the age of everything right now. Because of the rate of acceleration of the universe, like, it's even if time went on forever,
mm-hmm.
like, we still wouldn't be able to get, like, light all the way out to the edge of the universe, so, because of its expansion. Does that make sense?
Kind of, but
so
then
we can't really, like,
a little bit, because then you're saying that the universe has a predefined area, like, space. Like it's in a container.
No, like, it's at a point right now where we can't measure the edge of it because of the way that it's expanding.
But
is there
an
edge?
Point of, yeah, if it's expanding, it must be expanding into something. And so you have to envision.
Or just indefinitely, let's just say it's indefinitely expanding.
Uh-huh.
Right? Then, yeah, just the way that it was stated, I thought that there was, like, a premise for a container of some size.
Wait,
no.
Do you guys remember? This is way too informal now. it was an old idea about where the stars come from. I think it's called, like, the celestial veil or the celestial dome.
Go on.
Where all that starlight is the light of God shining through punctures in this black sphere that surrounds the Earth.
Huh.
Yeah, so imagine it's the Earth is in, like, a black ball.
Uh-huh.
And that black ball has points, has needle points to
it.
Sure. Okay. And then outside of that black ball is celestial light. So the Earth would just see
That's
those
interesting.
Little points coming
oh,
through. Just
okay.
a cool little thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. yeah. Gets it back into things that we might have answers to.
Huh.
Because I sure as hell don't understand any of this new astrophysics.
So,
the fact
that
we're holograms?
Yeah.
let's talk about it, Michael. Are we ready?
Not yet.
Oh, I got too excited.
So the universe started with the Big Bang.
And boy, was
probably,
it big.
Yeah. Probably. And a since then, it's been expanding from a single point, basically. So if you imagine an explosion, you know, the particles that come off of it are going to have a really fast acceleration at least initially, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to slow down over time. So that's kind of how we think about the universe as expanding. So it expands from a single explosion point. And over time, you would expect that the expansion slows down, right? Or it comes to some sort of, like, deceleration.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually not been the case. So the universe has actually been accelerating in terms of expansion. And the reason for that is what scientists believe is dark energy or dark matter has some sort of force that's pushing the objects farther away from each other.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's what's happening right now. So we're moving farther and farther apart.
At a faster and faster rate.
At a faster and faster rate.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Well, okay, think about that then also too. That's really interesting, right? So if dark matter is doing something like that, is it pushing from the inside of where the Big Bang blast was, or is it pulling from the outside?
I don't know.
Right? Cray cray, right?
I don't know.
I just did that.
Yeah.
Cray paper.
It's easier with your visualization, I think.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
But
oh, yeah. Marshall's doing some incredible right now. Some great space work.
But is it pushing from center, the center of the Big, of the Big Bang, or, right. yeah, pulling from whatever else is out there?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Cray.
Anyway. I don't know. Okay, so we're going to take a small break, I guess, and then start to do our little round table of discovery.
Okay. Of discovery.
So I hope that I don't have a lot of feedback here, but here we go. Okay, and we are back.
Hey,
I was
everybody.
Just telling Marshall about a really horrific incident that I saw in Chinatown on my way here.
Do not subject the listeners to that.
Okay, it was really bad.
It was bad. Yeah. Anyway, happy 5th of July.
Okay. Happy 5th of July again.
Yeah.
Listening to K-Chung on...
Start that.
Nature Boy on K-Chung Radio, sorry.
There you go.
16:30 a.m., broadcasting live from Chinatown, doing our callbacks. What is this? What are they doing? What are they pointing at? Okay, so we're talking about space, the universe, mm-hmm. astrophysics, things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I think what's always interested me most about, one of the things that's interested me most about space is black holes. So black holes are kind of like, I don't know, I like to think of them as like opposite stars, or like the inverse of stars.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they're just like these spherical kind of objects that maybe spherical. We see them as spherical, I think.
Totally.
And they suck in all matter and light, and they don't let it go. So it's what it's defined as is a mathematically defined region of space-time exhibiting such a strong gravitational pull that no particle or electromagnetic radiation can escape from it. So I think what I've always been interested about black holes about is like that they don't, that all matter is like kind of sucked into them, and it's kind of thought of as being lost or something. And in a lot of the science that we learn in like our general kind of chemistry classes, it's that matter is neither created nor destroyed; it mm-hmm. just, you know, changes
from
form.
Energy.
So
to matter.
What I've spent a lot of time thinking about is like what happens to matter in a black hole? Like what? How does it? How do you sort of? What am I? The word that I'm looking for is reconcile.
Sure.
That sort of like it gets sucked in, but it's not really lost. So what kind of happens to
all
it?
All black holes also have these huge energy jet streams, right? So
that gets like spewed out.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So and it's okay for matter to switch into energy or energy to turn into matter. That's why sometimes it's hard to conceptualize the idea that matter is neither destroyed, matter and energy are neither destroyed or created.
Yeah.
Right? But they switch back and forth. So
it could be those jets, yeah.
Right. All of the matter is getting sucked in, then it could be coming out in those jet streams.
Also, it used to be thought that like black holes never emitted any kind of radiation or energy. Well, I mean, apart
right.
from those like blasts, but I think recently Stephen Hawking sort of demonstrated that they actually do emit a type of radiation, but the like energy of it is so low that it's almost impossible to detect. It's like it's like billions of a Kelvin in temperature, so it's like it's extremely difficult to detect, and it's called Hawking radiation. So that's like the
I wonder energy then, that is it warm near a black hole?
Is it warm? No, I don't think it would be. Maybe.
Well,
I mean,
it couldn't be warm because there's no air molecules to transmit energy.
Well, the sun is warm.
The sun is warm.
So
I guess
I don't think it would be. I don't know.
It would,
if there's
the
some radiation.
Well, it would be radioactively intense there.
Right.
But unless you couldn't stick
it wouldn't
a
be
thermometer
like a heat.
Out and say, oh,
yeah.
it's hot.
Yeah, well,
just a lot of radioactivity.
The semantics of the verbiage that I chose to use.
I
apologize
to tell you
for
that's
that.
Science.
Yes, the radiation would make it, quote-unquote, warmer, right?
Quote-unquote,
warmer.
Right.
But warm is a sensation? Like, you feel warmer?
Well, I mean, so the black hole would be bombarding.
It would be radioactively hot.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So electrons would be moving up and down their energy gradients, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, good. We're there.
I think, yeah.
Okay, we're all there together.
Yeah. So, that's just kind of what I'm heading into is, like, what happens to sort of the information or the things that... get sucked inside of a black hole.
Okay.
And so that's where this theory comes from, the holographic principle. So this is actually like a pretty popular opinion in science right now, and there's not really any direct evidence for this, that like our universe is a hologram. but it's through indirect evidence. And I think that if scientists use this theory that we're living basically in a projection of a 2D mm-hmm. sort of surface, mm-hmm. it makes a lot of their like calculations and theories and things more probable, and like mm-hmm. their models easier to work with, which mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting. So I found a short video on this, so I'll just play it right now so you can listen. And I'll play it for you guys as well.
Thank you.
Back in the early 1970s, Stephen Hawking wrote down an astonishing equation. It would include relativity, it would include quantum mechanics, and it would include information. Hawking's rather simple equation brought us a step closer to understanding the relationship of quantum physics and black holes.
When an object crosses over the edge of a black hole, its event horizon, the object enters a realm basically of empty space, of darkness. And it continues to be dragged toward the center of the black hole, toward what we call the singularity, where it gets crushed out of existence. Every object, in some sense, contains information because it contains a very specific arrangement of particles. So where is the information that describes the arrangement of those particles? Where does it go?
Hawking's description of this process was that the energy remains, but the information disappears.
For many years, for decades, people wondered, is Hawking right? Is the information obliterated and disappears from the universe, or is it still there and perhaps can be in some way retrieved?
The destruction of information was counterintuitive, and it didn't match the rest of the things we knew. In all parts of physics, we had a situation where information doesn't get destroyed. So it was a bit puzzling.
This debate furiously went back and forth up through the 80s and into the 90s when people finally began to articulate this new principle, this holographic principle. And what it said is that all the things that were falling inside a black hole were somehow captured in a preserved image at the horizon itself.
So if the information is not lost on the surface, the information is not lost inside because they are equivalent.
All the information about those objects, what they were like in their three-dimensional existence, was preserved or encoded on the surface of the black hole. And that's a little bit like a hologram.
Well, that suggests that maybe that idea may apply more broadly to the universe as a whole. Maybe the three-dimensional objects, us, everything in the world around us, maybe all of the information in these objects is carried, is smeared around a distant two-dimensional surface that surrounds us, and we're just, in some sense, a holographic projection of that distant data.
The holographic principle tells us something quite astonishing. It says that our ideas of volume, of the real world, in a sense, might be a kind of illusion.
Okay, so
mind blown.
Yeah, that was a short video, and it doesn't really matter that it was a video because the visuals are horrible.
I think that we should briefly mention that the visuals were just common household objects like a lamp or a hat or a flashlight, and they just would fly through a black void and then explode into ones and zeros.
Yeah, they had like some sound effects in there that made it seem like maybe the video was important.
And yeah,
had a
lots of whooshing,
clarifying the like information. Whoa. But no, yeah. So anyway, yeah, that's a really interesting sort of theory to me. That's like sort of popular in physics right now, and it kind of suggests that maybe, you know, we might be living inside of a black hole type thing.
But you know, isn't that like their premise, though, that information, that they're saying that there has to be some kind of information cannot be destroyed or created there?
Right.
Yeah, that seems...
They use binary to represent it in the video, which is...
Sure, but that idea that...
For me, uh-huh. The first thing I thought of was like, okay, you have... like salt and water, mm-hmm. and you mix them together and you've changed the form, and now you have this, like, you know,
salt water.
Salt water,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
the information contained in the arrangement of the salt molecules is what they're talking about, the arrangement of particles.
Right.
So, do you have the initial information that describes the granule of salt contained within the salt water? I think that that's like a more simplified version of what they're saying. I think that's what they're getting at, but it's a short video, and I just, like I said, this stuff, it all sounds interesting, but then when you try to understand it, it's so confounding.
Yeah. Dang. I wish there was more information.
And I think that anything that makes the current models work better, I mean, that adds credence to something, but it's not enough to really, like, support it and move it and put it forward as like, this is how we should perceive the universe now.
Right.
Because look, all of our approximations,
all of these models work way better.
Yeah, this
like
is so much easier, you guys. Let's just eliminate every number above 10 because it's way easier.
I mean,
and division gone.
Decimal points, not necessary.
Don't need them. Sig figures, zero.
Yeah. Oh. What do you think, Michael?
I don't know. I don't know what to think about it. It's just like a really sort of abstract idea, I think, to consider that we're like a sort of three-dimensional projection of a 2D surface.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know how to... How do holograms have, like, thoughts and ideas and things like that? I don't know.
Yeah, well, also, too, then you're... I don't know.
I mean, I can... The way... I've heard lots of descriptions of higher dimensional beings
right.
projecting onto our, like, a three-dimensional landscape, and I think that
makes more sense.
Easier to understand and easier to, to comprehend, but it seems so odd. Like, how would you... Even something as simple as, okay, we're a two-dimensional organisms.
Whoa.
Right?
Sorry. What did you do last night?
Happy Fourth, Revelation. If we're two-dimensional organisms, then how do we, say, move over one another? How do we jump over another person? But how do we play leapfrog?
Mm-hmm.
Because... If we're two-dimensional, that would be impossible. You have two circles on a page. They can't coexist in the same space on a two-dimensional plane. But then we're talking about two-dimensional information.
Right. Yeah,
and if information is just specifying coordinates and things like this, then it could all be contained within information. But how... Why would... it's so confusing.
It is. Especially just also, too, that all of that... First, there's the premise that that information can't be destroyed, right? It has to stay somewhere, and so then it's imprinted onto the surface of a black hole. Maybe my mind is just too small for this right now.
Yeah,
but I cannot envision a universe that works like that.
It's like an analogous universe.
Uh huh.
You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem realistic at all based on anything that I've seen.
An ever-expanding, extremely infinite universe like we were talking about earlier. And information is cataloged on the surface of black holes. You guys should see my face.
Marshall's making a very...
No, it's a really, abstract idea. But that's why I think a lot of these sort of... astrophysics, like modern astrophysics, are like very abstracted because they're just like so intangible. I don't know.
And they're all models.
Yeah.
They're all theories.
But I also believe that a lot of the time these people do have a greater understanding of it, and it just takes too much to explain it.
Yeah.
So they try to make these analogies and metaphors. And
like, to get at your sort of like 2D versus 3D thing, like, I mean, holograms exist, like the... You know, Coachella, what was it? thing? I mean, that was like a 3D projection. You know, it had depth, but it came from a 2D sort of projector surface. So I don't know.
It's good. Yeah.
Information. Yeah, it's like
you can
create
a hologram.
Yeah,
it's printed on a 2D screen.
Yeah, but how those like independent elements have are like autonomous or like seemingly autonomous. I don't know. Maybe we would just like.
I think we would just need to take a course in this to really understand the ideas.
I mean, that's the thing about people in physics. Man, they are just on a whole other level of understanding about the way the universe works. But also, too, then I have to imagine if we're going to use that analogy, the Coachella hologram one, then, like, also, then are we also saying that every single black hole is linked to all the other black holes in, like, an information network? So that way they can project to every point in the universe? Because if my information is only stored in one hologram, when I'm on the opposite side...
No, I think that's like sort of what this theory is getting at. It's like what we know of the universe right now is only like this like single projection kind of that we're living in. And maybe the actual universe is much beyond what we currently know, which is even... weirder to think about, I think.
I mean, it would be really, really interesting because, like, when you encode a hologram, when you program that sort of thing, there is all that information that if you had two holograms that were able to perceive one another, all the coding behind that would be much more complex than the new hologram organisms would perceive it to be.
Right,
and there would be if they could perceive that code, they could understand what they were. But you know what Bram Stoker said: metaphor is more of a danger to science than wolves to man. That's a slight paraphrasing, but
cool. I like that.
That's a good Anyway, we're kind of
running short.
So what did you guys want to talk about?
You got a book? You want to go with your book?
Sure. Mine's quick because, as I've said now two or three times, I don't get any of this stuff. So, being that I don't get any of this stuff, I purchased a while back a copy of How to Teach Relativity to Your Dog. And one of the most discouraging things about this book is it's structured in these narrative way with conversations between this physicist and his pet dog, and the dog understands this stuff really quickly. And so the dog will say, oh, okay, I get it, let's move on. Like, moving, you know, when you move past an object, it looks shorter, of course, duh.
Moving on, and you're still there scratching your head like, damn you dog, why do you know more of this?
But, you know, it's not a real dog, it's a book dog. It doesn't, anyways, the point of the matter is, I've been reading this book. A lot of fun stuff. I thought I would just talk about space-time, because right in the beginning of the show, I think it was you who said space and time, and that was when I wanted to jump in and say, guys, we don't think about space and time anymore. We think about space-time.
Yeah.
Because in our contemporary view of the... not contemporary, but in the view of the universe that held before the theories of relativity... everything was measured based on distances, space distances. But if we adapt those measurements of space, then we eliminate the portions of physics that break down in very extreme conditions. And that's that's the reason relativity took so long to ever come up and become the forefront, to the forefront, is because the theories of relativity don't come into play until you're doing insane things like moving close to the speed of light, or until you're dealing with incredibly small particles,
or just because if I'm moving away from you faster than you're moving away from me, then technically there's a time shift, right? But that time shift is so minor when you actually do the calculations.
That it wouldn't matter in any situation we would ever
Unless you were at near the speed of light or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I think the easiest way to talk about space-time, I think I can synopsize a chapter from here in like 2 minutes. Let's see if we can make it happen. Okay, so you're going super quick. You're going 3/4 the speed of light. And you go past a ruler. The ruler is a foot long, right? Now, you're seeing that ruler as you move past it, but what matters is the time difference between when you see the beginning of the ruler and when you see the end of the ruler.
Wait, the ruler is in a fixed location.
Yeah.
Not moving.
Not moving.
Okay.
And you're moving past the ruler. Or, from your perspective, technically the ruler's moving and you're stationary.
Right.
So that's another fun
relativity
thing. Yeah, relativity thing.
Yep.
So if you're moving very, very quickly past the ruler, the time that the difference between the time you see the beginning of the ruler and the end of the ruler is a lot shorter than if you're standing stationary or if you're moving past it. So this makes the ruler appear to contract in space, and so it would look smaller.
How much smaller?
I'm not sure.
At 3/4 the speed of light, I feel like he should have had that calculation at that
point. It might be in this book. I mean, I don't know. It's not all in my brain, Marsh. Ask the dog,
good.
Okay?
Yeah.
But if you take that distance and you then divide it by the time that it took you to, by the time between the two observations of the beginning and the end of the object,
sure,
everything equalizes. And boom, now you can actually consistently measure the length of that ruler, no matter how fast you're moving, where you're observing from. Like, the observer's, every observation becomes the same. You may be in a different space relative to somebody else, and both of you will be able to see the same thing. And that's, like, the power of relativity. I think he put it here pretty well as... If you know what one observer sees, relativity lets you say with absolute certainty what any other observer will see. Which was kind of like a, whoa, what the hell? It's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, it's the speed of light is this constant thing, barrier that can't be overcome.
Mm-hmm.
We can use the speed of light as the standard for that time, right? And then what we do is we take time and we convert it into distance. So we all know the Pythagorean theorem,
right?
A squared equals B squared plus C squared.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you measure distances. That's the easiest way to do it, unless you're going to directly stretch a tape or something between two objects, right?
Sure. Yeah.
You can measure in the coordinate system, make a triangle, solve for the third leg of the triangle. So what you do is you take time, you convert it into a distance, and then you can deal with all of them because they're in the same units. And then you can do another equation where it's actually like A squared equals B squared plus C squared plus D squared.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually also plus E squared because we're moving in three dimensions and then time.
I like
four
it.
Dimensions.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like everything about that. But I have to say that probably not going to happen. We haven't got on the metric system, so it's going to be pretty hard to get on the universal system.
Well, and also the thing is that the real kicker with relativity is it has application for astrophysicists and things like that, but it doesn't have enough application in our day-to-day lives that we would ever want to measure things that way.
Right.
Adopting that system would make life more complicated.
It seems like more absolute.
What a good explanation that I've heard about space-time is like using the analogy of sort of... I know you just mentioned that analogies are bad for science, but I like this one. It was like if you imagine space-time to be like an actual sort of object, or like a tangible thing, it could be like sort of like a sheet, like a bed sheet that you spread over like a given distance, right? And if you have like these sort of gigantic objects like planets or something, they would put like, you know, put
balls
a ball
on
like on a sheet,
yeah.
And it would the fabric would sink in that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have like an elastic sheet, maybe it would be a better analogy. Like, it would stretch over that particular area, so sort of time, like space-time would be stretched out over that area, so time would sort of be stretched out as well. So, like, you know, time would be slower in that particular, like, around very large masses of objects.
And that's how Einstein explains gravity, also.
Right.
Are those deformations in the space-time sheet.
Fabric, yeah. So, like, in that movie
Interstellar.
Yeah,
we're going there. We have to go there.
Actually, so my husband's a K-12 teacher.
Yes.
And he does physical science. And now they want the students to watch Interstellar because it's a great explanation of relativity for them.
Yeah.
Something very tangible.
Like, when they're on that water planet or something, then they're on there for, like, 2 hours or something.
Yeah.
And then it's, like,
been
20
years.
And I don't think it's... the effect is that pronounced So if they were like on a spacecraft hovering above that planet, you know, it shouldn't have been like that much of a difference.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm not a physicist, so maybe. I'm sure they had good consultants.
The physicists all agreed.
So. Oh, they all agreed.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, what are you trying to say, Michael?
I don't know. It just doesn't seem beyond my understanding.
Well, something that I brought that might be a yes. little easy for everybody's understanding is we kind of started with that there are new laws out there, right, about now people are going to have to start vaccinating. And the Supreme Court actually just heard argument from this biotech firm called Myriad. Mm-hmm. And
I've seen that name.
Yeah. So they own the patents on BRCA1 and BRCA2, these genes that are... known for, if you have mutations in them, you're much more likely to get breast or ovarian cancer.
Sure. Yeah.
So they owned the patents to these genes previously. And so whenever another firm or researchers tried to come up with cheaper, easier testing methods to test and screen people for having these mutations, Myriad was stepping in and saying, no, that's our patentable material, you're not allowed to do anything with BRCA1 or BRCA2 unless you get our consent first.
Right.
So any tests that you have are illegal or you have to pay us a royalty. Well, the Supreme Court just invalidated their patent on BRCA1 and BRCA2 in that context. Mm-hmm. So they say that you're not allowed to patent a gene like that with the exons and introns. But if you have the cDNA for a specific gene, now that is something patentable. Hmm. Interesting, right?
So you can still patent genes for uses in biotechnology, like to engineer that gene into something else.
Exactly.
Which makes sense. And that's exactly what I was thinking when you were describing this, mm-hmm. is that's not a valid use of the patent. You can't just say, oh, we patent this thing we didn't create,
yeah,
and now yep. you can't modify it or look at its sequence or do anything.
Yeah, and see, so that's where the Supreme Court was also agreeing, was yeah. that this is a problem because now you're stifling people's ability
yeah.
to...
Like, I patented trees, so you can't build yeah. a house.
And they said just because you put in significant time and money doesn't automatically mean that you have something patentable.
Yeah.
We understand that you went through a lot of effort to find BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Yeah.
But just because you went through a lot of effort doesn't mean that you have the right.
Hey, that's something they taught us in our first year of graduate school, and it really stuck with me, is that nobody cares how hard you worked. And,
right.
and
right.
they shouldn't either, because yeah. it doesn't matter, unless they're trying to recreate your research,
right.
and then they should care a little bit because they're going to have to work that hard too.
Sure. It reminds me of that company, the 23andMe. So they yeah. Sequence your like genome, right, mm-hmm. or parts of it,
mm-hmm.
So they can tell you like your ancestry and things like that. But then they also used to sell like, or a part of their service was telling you if you have markers for certain diseases,
yeah, your health history.
And so it was really like, I think, a really valuable tool for people. It was only like $100, and you can get like all this like, you know, information if you're likely to get a certain disease.
Yeah.
And they had to stop selling that because...
People don't want to know.
Because they can't sell medical information because they're not, like, a medical company.
Yeah. It was really interesting. Well, and then also, too, Myriad was trying to say that... Or get patents on... Nobody is allowed to recreate 15 nucleotide chunks of BRCA1 or BRCA2. You know what they're doing there, right? They're stopping people... from being able to make primers,
yeah,
for the gene. You can't even do research if you're going to not be able to make primers. Also, too, then you won't be allowed to test.
Is that in any other, like, do you know of any other, because I don't do molecular biology very often, sure. but do you know of any other, like, instance where people are blocked from making a primer of something?
No. See, and the Supreme Court shot them down for that one, too, because uh-huh. they were trying to get a patent for it, and they said, that's not patentable, it's way too amorphous. This is something that is a standard for the industry and how people do research. You can't invalidate primers.
Yeah.
So, so it was really interesting, but I did think that it was also crazy that the Supreme Court even thinks that cDNA is, there's enough human intervention by excising the introns that it's now patentable man-made. What do you guys think about that?
Mm.
I really think I think it all, and this, I just think that the law structure doesn't fit this new, these new technologies.
Sure.
And so they have to modify it as they go, and that's the way the new laws are crafted. But it would be really nice
really
if we didn't, if we didn't have to fit genetic technology like this into this framework that's built, that's designed for freaking like watches and stuff.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Patent law when it comes to biological or things that occur in nature, it just, I don't know, gets me
and going. The patents for I think glyphosate resistance are expiring soon too, so now Roundup Ready products will be able to be adopted by more people soon.
Interesting.
We'll have what's that, we're in generic brand Roundup,
unless they get Disney's lawyers involved and they can extend that patent out forever.
We are out of time here. Thank you for listening to Nature Boy. I think this is this our 12th episode?
This is episode 12.
Wow.
One year. Yeah.
Happy 1 year anniversary, guys.
Yeah.
Happy 5th of July.
This is when we get syndicated, right?
Woo!
Okay, I'm going to just play this one song as we leave. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.